All right, let's dive in. Today we are looking at Tatman v. Collins, at the Fourth Circuit case from back in 1993. And, you know, on the surface, it might seem like just another dusty old legal case, but trust me, this one really gets to the heart of how depositions are used in court.
Yeah, you know, it goes way beyond just like the basic procedural rules. This case digs into like the real nitty-gritty of trial strategy, what happens when, you know, you hit a snag, things don't go as planned. It can have huge implications for how a case actually plays out.
Absolutely. And that's what makes it so interesting to unpack, right? Like at its core, Tatman v. Collins is all about the exclusion of a medical expert's deposition. And that exclusion, spoiler alert, ended up leading to a directed verdict. So yeah, it really makes you think about what's at stake when a seemingly minor procedural issue can end up silencing a key witness.
Yeah.
You know, potentially changing the entire outcome of a trial.
Right. And the stakes are always high, especially in cases like wrongful death suits, which is what we're dealing with here.
Okay, so let's rewind the clock back to 1986, set the scene for everyone. We have Monty Tatman. Unfortunately, he gets rear-ended in a car accident. The other driver involved is a guy named Bobby Wayne Collins. So Mr. Tatman, you know, he's injured, right? He goes to see Dr. Joseph Amico for treatment. Seems pretty straightforward so far, right? A typical car accident case?
Yeah, fender bender, injuries, treatment, happens all the time.
Exactly. But here's where it takes a turn. Sadly, almost a year later, Mr. Tatman passes away.
Mm-hmm.
The cause, a ruptured cerebral aneurysm.
And that's where this case gets really complicated and tragic, frankly. So in 1988, 2 years after the accident, Mr. Tatman's wife, she files a wrongful death lawsuit against Mr. Collins. And her argument, her central claim, is that the injuries her husband sustained in that car accident, they were directly related to the aneurysm that ultimately took his life.
Okay, so she's alleging that the accident, even though it happened a year earlier, set off this chain of events that led to his death. That's a tough argument to make, right? Like proving that connection, that causal link between the accident and the aneurysm, especially with such a time gap.
Oh, absolutely. That burden of proof, showing causation, that's a major hurdle in these types of cases. You can't just say, well, maybe the accident contributed. You got to show a reasonable probability that the accident directly caused the aneurysm to a degree of medical certainty.
So how did they try to do that? I mean, how did the plaintiff's attorneys go about trying to prove that this car accident a year earlier led to Mr. Tatman's death?
Well, they pinned a lot of their hopes on the deposition of Dr. Joseph Amico. Remember, he was the treating physician who saw Mr. Tatman right after that rear-end collision. The deposition was taken during discovery, you know, that phase of the lawsuit where both sides gather information, build their case.
Right. Discovery. Depositions, interrogatories, requests for production, the whole shebang.
Yeah.
It's all about gathering the evidence you need to present your case.
Exactly. And in this case, Dr. Amico's deposition was seen as crucial. As the treating physician, he had that firsthand knowledge of Mr. Tatman's condition immediately following the accident. So his testimony, his expert medical opinion, was going to be a cornerstone in establishing that causal link.
He was the link, potentially, between the accident and the eventual aneurysm.
Right. But here's the twist. When the trial day actually rolled around, Dr. Amico had an unavoidable scheduling conflict. He couldn't be there in person to testify. Happens sometimes. So the plaintiff's lawyers, they did what seemed logical. They moved to introduce his pretrial deposition testimony as evidence, you know, since he couldn't be there live.
Seems like a reasonable move.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened? Did the court allow it?
Well, that's where the wrench gets thrown into the gears. The district court judge actually decided to exclude Dr. Amico's deposition.
Really? So why? What was the reasoning there? I mean, it seems like if a witness can't physically be at trial, their deposition should be allowed as evidence.
You'd think so, right? But the court gave two main reasons for excluding it. First, they said it was a discovery deposition. Like, it was only meant for gathering information, not for use at trial. And second, they pointed out that Dr. Amico practiced in Columbus, Ohio, which, while more than 100 miles from the Charleston, West Virginia courthouse where the trial was being held, was still within 100 miles of the Southern District of West Virginia's northern border.
Okay, so they're basically saying the doctor wasn't far enough away to be considered truly unavailable, and that this discovery deposition label somehow made it inadmissible.
It's starting to sound like a bit of a technicality, right? Like they're focusing on the label of the deposition rather than the substance of the testimony. Yeah, you're picking up on what's at stake here. And remember, we're talking about a wrongful death case, a grieving widow seeking justice for her husband. So the stakes are incredibly high. And this exclusion, this procedural hurdle, had a domino effect. because the plaintiff's other expert witness, a Dr. Wecht, had based his opinions about the cause of death on Dr. Romico's findings. So guess what? His testimony got tossed out too.
Wow, so one excluded deposition took down their entire expert strategy? That's tough.
It was a major blow. Without the medical experts, the plaintiff couldn't establish that crucial causal link between the accident and the aneurysm. And the result was a directed verdict in favor of the defendants. The judge basically said, there's not enough evidence here for this case to go to the jury. Case closed.
So the exclusion of that deposition essentially shut down the entire case. And that's a tough break for the plaintiff. So what happened next? Did they just accept this outcome?
No way. They appealed the decision, naturally. They specifically challenged the district court's decision to exclude Dr. Romico's deposition. And this appeal, it brought up two really big legal questions that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals had to grapple with.
Okay, let's hear them. What were the big legal issues at play here?
All right, so the first question was this. Under the FRCP, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, specifically Rule 32, can depositions that were taken for discovery purposes, like fact-finding, can those be used as evidence in trial if the witness is unavailable? And the second question revolved around that 100-mile rule we talked about, you know, the rule that determines whether a witness is considered unavailable. So the question was, how do you measure that distance? Is it from the actual courthouse building or from the outer limits of the judicial district?
So those are some pretty fundamental questions, right? They get to the heart of how our legal system works, balancing the need for gathering information efficiently before a trial, but also making sure everyone has a fair shot at presenting their case to a jury.
Absolutely. And the Fourth Circuit, they ended up disagreeing with the district court on both counts. They reversed the decision.
So a big win for the plaintiff on appeal. Okay, so break it down for us. What was the Fourth Circuit's reasoning? Why did they overturn the lower court's ruling?
Well, on that first issue, the discovery deposition issue, the appellate court was very clear. They basically said there's no such thing as a discovery deposition in the eyes of the law. The FRCP makes no distinction between depositions taken purely for gathering information and those specifically taken to preserve testimony for trial. A deposition is a deposition, period.
So for those of us who aren't legal experts, what does that actually mean?
It means that any deposition can be used at trial if the witness is unavailable for one of the reasons listed in Rule 32. You don't have to go through this extra step of taking a second identical deposition and labeling it a trial deposition just because you think you might need it later.
Makes sense. So the court's taking a practical approach here. No need to duplicate efforts.
Right. Efficiency is key. No need to waste time and resources on a technicality. The testimony's there. It's under oath. It's admissible.
Okay, so that's the first issue. What about the 100-mile rule? How do they interpret that?
All right, so remember, the district court had said the place of trial in the rule meant the whole Southern District of West Virginia. But the Fourth Circuit, they said, nope, that's too broad. They specifically stated that place of trial means the physical courthouse, the building where the trial is actually happening.
Okay, so a very literal interpretation, not the whole district, just the courthouse.
Exactly. And their reasoning was that the whole point of the 100-mile rule is to acknowledge that it's a burden to make someone travel a long distance to testify. So measuring from the courthouse makes the most sense, makes it fair for the witnesses.
Makes sense. And in this case, Dr. Romico's practice in Columbus, Ohio, was definitely more than 100 miles from the courthouse in Charleston, West Virginia.
Yep. So he met the definition of unavailable according to the rules.
So essentially, the Fourth Circuit said the lower court got it wrong on both counts. They shouldn't have excluded the deposition, and because of that, they shouldn't have issued a directed verdict.
Right, and because of that ruling, the case was sent back down to the lower court for further proceedings, you know, so they could actually consider Dr. Romico's deposition and let the jury decide.
Wow, so one little deposition really shook things up, huh? It's like a legal butterfly effect.
It really shows you how these seemingly technical rules can have huge real-world consequences. But it wasn't a unanimous decision, you know? There was a dissenting opinion in this case. Judge Hall, he wrote it, and it raises some interesting points worth thinking about.
Okay, what did the dissent have to say?
Well, Judge Hall's main argument was that trial judges, they should have more discretion when it comes to making decisions about evidence. He felt the trial judge in the Tatman case was within his rights to exclude the deposition. You know, it was all about judicial discretion.
Interesting. So he wasn't necessarily disagreeing with the interpretation of the rules, but rather with how much leeway a trial judge should have in applying them.
Right. It was more about the principle of it. And he also had concerns about what he called trial by ambush. He felt that the plaintiff's attorneys, they hadn't been totally upfront with the defense about potentially using the deposition at trial. You know, because the deposition was taken early in the discovery process, the defense might have assumed it was just for information gathering, not for actual use at trial.
Yeah, I can see how that could be an issue. Like, it could create an unfair advantage if one side is planning to use a deposition at trial, but doesn't give the other side a heads up.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of goes against the spirit of fairness in the legal process, right?
Exactly. And Judge Hall was also a bit skeptical about the strength of the plaintiff's argument overall. Like, even if they had the expert testimony, could they really prove that a relatively minor car accident caused an aneurysm almost a year later? It's a valid question.
So it sounds like the dissenting opinion raises some important points about fairness, transparency, and, you know, making sure the evidence presented is actually relevant and reliable.
Right. It's not just about following the rules blindly. It's about making sure those rules are applied in a way that leads to a fair and just outcome. And Tatman v. Collins, it really highlights that tension.
So let's recap here for everyone listening. What are the key takeaways, the big lessons to learn from this case?
Okay. Well, first and foremost, always remember that depositions are powerful tools. Don't underestimate them. They're not just for discovery. They can absolutely be used as evidence at trial. And when it comes to that 100-mile rule, the distance is measured from the courthouse itself, not the whole district.
Those are crucial points. Mm-hmm. So anyone studying law out there, you need to be thinking about these things from the very beginning of a case. Like, even when you're taking those initial depositions, always ask thorough questions. Cover all the bases, because you never know when a witness might become unavailable.
Exactly. Treat every deposition like it could be used at trial. And on a broader level, Tatman v. Collins really makes you think about the role of procedural rules. Like, sometimes strictly sticking to the letter of the law, it can actually lead to outcomes that feel unfair, right? It highlights the importance of discretion and common sense in applying those rules.
Yeah, finding that balance between procedure and fairness, it's not always easy. And it's something that you'll grapple with throughout your legal careers. All right, so any final thoughts for our listeners before we wrap up?
Well, I'd say this case is a great example of how the rules of evidence, especially when it comes to expert testimony, can get really tricky. It makes you think about how to challenge expert opinions, even if they technically meet the requirements. And it highlights the need for thorough preparation.
Absolutely. So keep those things in mind as you continue your studies. And until next time, keep exploring the fascinating world of the law. It's full of twists and turns, just like Tatman v. Collins.